And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The race is on, or rather, it's soon to be off for Kevin Magnussen and Romain Grosjean, with confirmation that neither will continue to drive for Haas in 2021. The latest step in the driver market perhaps isn't a huge surprise, but likely means neither driver will be on the Formula One grid next year. I'm Ed Straw, and joining me to discuss everything Haas is Mark Hughes. Well, let's delve straight into it, Mark. I guess it's not a great surprise that they're both out, but it's potentially the end in F1 for two drivers who've been a big part of Formula One in recent years, isn't it?
It is, yes, and unfulfilled potential for both of them, really. They didn't make that leap from the initial promise into the big leagues, and they were both sort of really treading water by signing for Haas, but in the hope that they could build something together, I guess, and progress together. But it hasn't really happened. The team is sort of, its form has been patchy, hasn't it? And there's no clear direction that it's going, that it's moving forward. It was its best season was 2018, which was, it was building nicely up to that point. But then last year was a disaster, and this year is probably just as bad for different reasons. So yeah, the momentum for the drivers' careers is long past that peak where they're fashionable. So if Haas has decided for whatever reason, probably financial, that it wishes to go with a fresh lineup, probably rookies, then yeah, that's obviously, it's left no place for either Roman or Kevin.
Yeah, and Gunter Steiner, the team principal, pretty much accepted that because next year's a carryover year, there will be a step forward from the Ferrari power unit package of some sort, but next year's not going to be a big season for Haas. He said they're not going to be back on 2018 level by any stretch of the imagination. So it's kind of a situation, isn't it, whereby the team might as well get some resources in. Looks like they're going to go with a rookie lineup, so it's kind of forced that situation. He was evasive on who the candidates might be, but there's quite a few who've been extensively talked about, haven't there? Nikita Mazepin's one, well-backed F2 driver, race-winning F2 driver. Obviously, the Ferrari Driver Academy drivers have been linked to that seat as well. So it looks like, having kind of not been keen on inexperience in the past, they could end up with two rookies in the car.
Yeah, and I guess it's they're trying to build up the databanks of the rookies for 2022, when hopefully Haas is going to be able to use the opportunity of the new regulations to at least claw back some of the deficit that it's suffering with this car, which is essentially going to be carried over into next year. So yeah, using 21 really is just a foundation year for two rookies, and really for the on the technical side to be focused very much on the year after.
Yeah, which you can understand. And if they can translate that into really developing the 2022 car to take a big step forward, and then potentially have drivers who've got some experience of the following year. You can see the argument for it, but it's difficult, isn't it? Because you do see a team not quite giving up on a year, but accepting that it is what it is. And even if they got rid of these two drivers, which you can make a case for, if they brought in, been able to convince, we should even say, a Perez or a Hülkenberg to come in with their experience, that would be one thing. But if it's going to be rookies, that's going to be a little bit different, I guess. But I guess that's realism from Haas, you would say. You always want the team to take the best drivers possible, but sometimes you've got to look slightly longer term and take on board the financial realities. If it's one step back driver-wise to go two or three steps forward and have a stronger lineup and car for 22, then it would be justified, wouldn't it?
Yes, and it would be very hard to do a convincing sales pitch to someone like Sergio Perez on the basis of that, on the basis of we're not going to have a very strong season next year. Unless you were going to keep either one or both of Kevin or Roman, the obvious next thing is to look for a promising young guy or someone who can contribute to the budget. And it looks like we're going to have a combination of the two next year.
Well, let's have a look at the two outgoing drivers. Should we have a chat about Kevin Magnussen first? Now, they're both funny drivers, really interesting drivers, in that they're capable of great things and not so great things, should we say. Magnussen, in their 4 years together, has had the better set of results overall. He's outscored Grosjean. One of those drivers who is quite a mixed bag of weekends, isn't it? He's had ones this year where he's been really strong. For example, the race at Hungary was outstanding when he managed to get into the points. And there have been other weekends where he's been strong, but there have been other ones where, you know, he had a run of throwing it off in qualifying, trying a little bit too hard, and other races where sometimes he does go missing a little bit if the car's just struggling to a certain level. So what do you make of Magnussen overall? He's had a good run in Formula One. He's had good days and bad days. I guess he hasn't quite made a 100% compelling case to stay on, even though there's real ability there.
Yeah, and I mean, he sort of burst onto the scene, didn't he, with that podium place on his debut for McLaren. And he didn't quite make a case for himself being retained there. Although it was very close, the decision between whether in the following year it would be him or Jenson Button. And in the end, that really was probably when he looks back on his career, he'll probably look back on that moment as when his career might have been something more than it turned out to be. Since then, he's sort of been, he's been staying in the game. He's very very tough guy in wheel-to-wheel battle. He's got a reputation for someone that is, let's say, physical, can be physical. He's really tough. We can recall that incident he had with Pierre Gasly in Baku a couple of years ago, a couple of incidents that weekend that just sort of added to that reputation. He's very adaptable to a wide range of car traits. He can get some sort of tune out of any sort of setup, really. He's quite, despite being a tough guy in the car, in personality, he's a nice guy. He doesn't create waves in the team. But probably missing the last little ounce of ultimate speed. And so doesn't make an obvious case for himself. He's easily worthy of a place on the F1 grid, but doesn't make an obvious case that he has to be on the F1 grid.
Yeah, you always end up in a vulnerable position if you're kind of one of those drivers who should be there, but there's always going to be some drivers who should be there who get displaced by ones who get there for other reasons or when new guys have to come in. So it is tricky. But a driver who's produced some very, very memorable moments and contributed some good highs as well to Haas in recent years. How about Roman Grosjean? I find him a fascinating driver, as quick as anyone on his day. He has turned in some great drives and still continues to this year have some very strong weekends as well as some not so strong weekends. I wrote a piece on the race website arguing that he's among the best drivers never to win a Grand Prix. I don't think he ever made the most of that prodigious ability. Maybe that run in the second half of 2013 was when we saw what he was capable of, but it was just a flash, really, wasn't it, of a few months. What do you make of him? A mercurial driver and just somebody who, I guess, his weaknesses just undermined those great strengths that did exist.
Yeah, I'd go along with that. In addition to the second half of 13, there was the first half of 2012 as well, where he was quite exceptional. And I'm thinking back to Valencia in particular, where he could quite easily have won, and it would have been a marvellous victory too. But something mechanical in the Renault engine let him down. Yeah, his peaks are outstanding, and if he could only have hooked together those peaks, he could have had a great career. And there's something about his approach that just doesn't quite allow him full access to that talent, and that talent is extraordinarily high. I often think if he'd encountered early in his career, in his F1 career, a good, strong-minded engineer that inspired him and caused him to approach things, look at how he did things differently, we may have seen the joining up of those peaks, and we may have seen he would have made a case for himself to be signed by a top team. But there was clearly missing bits of his armory, and they're still apparent today. Even though he's now very, very experienced, those missing bits are still apparent. But so are the highs. He's still capable of turning in amazing performances, and his talent is just his raw speed. But it needs the car in a very particular window to be able to access that. And if he'd had an engineer that had been able to get him there and maybe widen his window a little bit, I think he could have had a great career.
Yeah, he probably had his best days when he was driving for Eric Bouyer at Lotus. And of course, Bouyer did come from an engineering background. He wasn't engineering him or anything, but because he was the team boss. But he did a lot of work just to try and get the most out of Grosjean. And it's interesting. It's funny to wonder if that team had carried on the trajectory it was, if it got the extra investment in, maybe things would have been a little bit different rather than going down the road of struggle. But overall, that driver lineup, it's a weird one because you've got two drivers who you're just never quite sure what you're going to get. And I guess if you're talking about trading that for rookie drivers, you never necessarily know exactly what you're going to get with rookie drivers in terms of their progression, etc. Sometimes it takes a bit of time for people to really adapt to it, even the very good. Sometimes ones who maybe look less promising actually settle in very, very well and start to overachieve compared to what you expect. But you could argue that wouldn't be a million miles away from what they've got now, where you just never know going into a weekend whether Magnussen or Grosjean's going to have a strong weekend or both. Or neither. So, I mean, Steiner was saying we needed to change something. We might as well roll the dice and make a change because this hasn't quite worked. And as I think you argued in our verdict piece on the race website, neither of those two drivers has made that team their own. And even in limited machinery, a driver always has the chance to do that, and that will get noticed, won't it?
Yeah, exactly. There's something in there. The way their personalities are, something in the way they're wired up, they're not proactive in how they go about the business of being a Grand Prix driver. They're almost just employees. They turn up and they do the job, and sometimes that job's very good, sometimes it's not. But they don't seem to be proactive in getting the team sort of spinning around them and centered upon them, which is part of the skill of you know, it's a difference between very often a very successful career and a so-so career for drivers of equal ability.
Still a shame we probably didn't see the best of either of them consistently, shall we say, because that they both have the raw material, but equally that they had their shot, didn't they? When it comes to Haas, do you think that position of, well, we might as well have a bit of a go next year and change something because we know that it's not going to be a great year is a sensible approach for them to take?
I think they're just being honest. It's probably not the position they would like to be in. Their hopes really have got to be on these 2022 regulations doing as they're intended to do and making it not so feasible for the bigger teams to establish such a big unbridgeable lap time superiority over the smaller teams. And it is uniquely small. I mean, even among small teams, it's small because of the way it's structured. With they don't make the car, and it's designed and built by third parties. So that model seemed to work to a degree in 2018, but the downsides were very clear. The last couple of seasons, when you hit a technical problem and you just don't have the depth of resource to A, research and understand it, and B, quickly correct it. It's something that will tend to go on a long time if you hit a snag. So their hope has got to be that the new formula sort of comes around to them rather than them being able to suddenly stretch up and become a leading team, because that it's not really feasible for that under the current operating conditions.
Yeah, and to be fair to them, there is promise there, because the overriding limitation this year is the Ferrari engine package. While the car's not sensational, they do seem to have eliminated the big problem they had last year with the rear aero stalling when they were in the sort of medium speed corners, the slower corners, and that caused them all sorts of trouble all year, led to them overcooking the rear tyres, and yeah, it was a nightmare year. So they kind of got on top of that, but it's strange, isn't it? Because they've got a lot of promise in that, because they use the latest Ferrari bit, so it's all 2020 Ferrari non-listed parts, as they're called, that they're allowed to take, and then they put their aero kit on it, for want of a better word, developed by Dallara. So it's very difficult to judge the potential of a team like that, isn't it? And we have seen them being best of the midfield at times, never quite managing to do it race in, race out. There's always been that inconsistency, shall we say, which I think does lie in the capacity to kind of crunch through all the data, etc. They are still a small team because of the way they operate. But yeah, it's been a really tough couple of seasons for them, hasn't it? So you can understand why they want to regroup maybe a little bit. And even though they signed up for Concord for the long haul, we're still not 100% sure exactly what the future of that team holds, because Gene Haas was disappointed with the fact that it was a bit of a struggle to get sponsorship in to make it all add up. Got the cost cap coming in, etc. There's all sorts of things that means F1 is more equitable. But it's still a bit into the unknown for Haas, isn't it? And I wonder if the work that's going to be done next year in the background off track is going to be, well, it just will be far more important than anything goes on track, which I guess is the team's mindset.
Yeah, the litmus test is obviously going to be 2022. And my guess is that if the prospects don't significantly improve, then Gene Haas is going to lose interest and is going to be looking to sell the team. That's just my hunch. That's not based on any intelligence. Next year is basically the platform for defining the shape of the team in the future and the ownership of the team, I would say.
In terms of alternative drivers, Nikita Mazepin, as we've mentioned, seems to be strongly linked to it. A decent driver, decent record in GP3 or F3, whichever it was called that year, I've lost track, and F2, he has won races. So, you know, he's a handy driver, if not quite a superstar. What do you make of his prospects? Clearly there's backing there. It seems to be going towards him, provided, of course, he has all the necessary super license points.
Yeah, he's won a couple of Formula 2 races this year. He's one of the front runners in there. Fully competent driver, but he hasn't done nothing to mark him out as an obvious superstar. Someone that teams would be clambering over themselves to sign if it wasn't for his backing. It's not to denigrate him, but it's just a realistic assessment of his level. That's not to say he couldn't develop. Plenty of people have developed into having great Grand Prix careers from similar sort of base. He wouldn't disgrace himself, but it's not someone you'd get excited about, let's say.
Yeah, exactly. I think a worthy enough driver. Both those F2 wins have been feature race wins, so they're not the slightly cheaper sprint race ones, shall we say. But yeah, it'd be clear what the reason is. And of course, he has done some testing with Mercedes even in the past, and Racing Point as well, so has a little bit of F1 seat time. The other seat seems a little bit more uncertain. There's Ferrari Driver Academy drivers floating around. The whole situation with who's going to be driving where regards that seems to have become quite muddy recently, doesn't it? It sort of goes one day, it seems to be quite clear. So obviously you've got your Callum Ilots, Mick Schumacher's are in that mix, and there could be any number of other drivers, I guess, floating around. Günther Steiner says they haven't made a final decision yet, which I'm not totally convinced by, but we can only go by what he says. So what do you make of the other candidates?
Yeah, well, the Ferrari juniors, as I say, the Ferrari are obviously very keen to place them in some Formula One seats for next year in the lesser teams, just to give them some mileage and assess their potential. But it's not totally Ferrari's say. You know, the Alfa has a say whether they want to retain their current lineup or give one of those seats up to a Ferrari Junior, and that has an impact down the line upon who's available or who's being foisted upon Haas from Ferrari. So Callum Ilott, Mick Schumacher, both have obvious potential. Both, you know, they're the two leaders of the F2 championship this year. One of them is going to be the champion. So yes, they both warrant being given an F1 chance, and it would be very interesting to see either of them in the Haas to see how they got on.
Yeah, I think that's whatever happens next year, it will be interesting to follow their progress. And yeah, I'm not that keen on a team in that situation not having any experience in their driver lineup. I did ask Gunter Steiner about this, how important is experience going to be, and he gave an answer that gave the impression that he knows full well that two rookies is very possible. And he did say there is every chance that can backfire, but also it can work quite well. Sometimes these inexperienced lineups can go either way, can't they? And you might get a fresh approach, or even the team might benefit from having drivers they can kind of imprint their way on, having maybe had in Grosjean and Magnussen two drivers with a particular way of doing things. Not necessarily always that compatible, those two as well, because they have quite different demands in terms of how the car is. I remember when Grosjean was complaining about understeer in the car, Magnussen was saying, no, it's not got an understeer problem. And you think you've got two people there with just very, very different requirements. So it's a roll of the dice on track, but off track a sound move is the final verdict, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a longer term move, because if you were looking upon next year as your foundation season, why would you continue with your existing drivers unless you thought they were going to be there long term? So I think the long term bit is in the past. So for those two, and so yes, that's pretty much a summary of it.
Well, thanks very much, Mark Hughes, for your insight in this short podcast about the Haas situation. There's loads to read on the race.com website, and don't forget the hyphen, my piece on Roman Grosjean. I think you've got a piece comparing Magnussen and Grosjean in their Haas time together coming up at some point, and obviously you can read in depth what Gunter Steiner has been saying and all the other latest from the Portuguese Grand Prix weekend. Then of course we'll turn our attention to F1's first race at the Algarve circuit. Probably going to be a really interesting weekend at a great circuit, and we'll be back after the race to do our usual post-race analysis. So join us then on the Race F1 podcast.